You're listening to Distraction Therapy with Rob Watson. Conversations about how we find meaning in our lives and what it's like to be part of a meta-modern world. Hello, this is Distraction Therapy with me, Rob Watson. Today I'm out and about for a stroll. I've been into Leicester City Centre for a coffee, and now I'm sitting in Castle Gardens, which is just off the city centre, near, just by St. Mary de Castro Church, and overlooking the River Soar, or the canalised part of the River Soar. And yeah, it's quite a pleasant day. It's turned into spring. It's warming up. May is here. It's almost as if over the last 2 weeks the trees have just suddenly burst into a canopy of green, and everything feels, as the sunlight falls through, it's got that lovely kind of emerald feel to it, translucent feel to the light. And the flowers are starting to pick out the vegetation is looking very sumptuous at the moment. I always like May and June. I think they're possibly the best months in England to enjoy the countryside, and you've really got to make the most of it. The days are getting longer, and it's starting to get warm enough to do things like take your coat off and put your shorts on, and the heating's been off for a few weeks, and we are starting to enjoy some aspects. You know, it's always this thing of the dangling, if you like, of the promise of a decent summer, which in my experience never materialises. We don't have those long, warm continental holidays that I dream about. It tends to be showers, four or five different weather patterns. You can get up in the morning, it can be glorious, and by the time you're ready to get out, it's started to rain and it's gone cold. And then you get a few hours of sunshine again in the evening, and you have to put a fleece on to sit out in the yard or the garden. But, you know, it always has been like that, and it always will be. Hey, what's coming up today? Well, let me consult my notes. I haven't done a personal reflection podcast for a while, so I thought it might be a good idea to get back into the habit of getting out and about. And I enjoy speaking with Ryan, but we don't do it every week, and we do go a bit heavy on the conversation sometimes, which is nice, but it means some of the more kind of aspects of being out and about and discovering things and reflecting on things I'm not paying that much attention to. So, what I'm going to do is I've got some things to talk through, some ideas, some stuff I've been reading and stuff I've been doing, and I thought I'd just kind of prattle through them while playing some music. And so the first song I've got lined up is Heart Rides On by Isabella Waller-Bridge.
Silence.
So that was Heart Rides On by Isabella Waller-Bridge. I don't normally do this kind of DJ thing of introducing tracks. Maybe I shouldn't. Anyway, I've spent a lot of time in the last couple of months following a lecture series on YouTube by John Vivacki entitled Escaping from the Meaning Crisis or Emerging from the Meaning Crisis. And a really impressive set of lectures. There's 50 of them, about an hour each, which is quite a challenge to keep listening to them so you get through them. But there's a real sense of a journey and a sense of a thread that runs through them. And Vivacki talks about this. This is this idea in metamodernism that we are defined by the crisis of meaning. Is that it's very difficult for us to find the ground on which we stand, which gives us a sense of meaning in life, because the prior things that used to give us meaning don't play such a central role. So he describes it as the wisdom institutions that we previously relied on are no longer central to our thinking, not for everybody, but for many people. And the danger is that there's a kind of, you can reach for fanaticism, or you can reach for a kind of hyper rationalism, and that what you stop being able to do is to look at issues in the round and as connected to a human experience. So a really kind of a tour of Western philosophy and some of its interconnections with other philosophical systems and approaches, which kind of maps through Western thinking from the ancient Greeks up to the present day, and how the split, what he describes as the kind of the Platonic notion of the split between the object and the subject, and is fundamentally at the heart of the meaning crisis. The axial revolution was that we considered our experience in two modes which weren't necessarily compatible: the subjective mode and the objective mode, which meant that we are unable to come to terms with the intuitive inner experience that we have, the unconscious experience that we have, and the world in which we live, the sensory experience that we are part of. And so there's a kind of an oscillation, if you like, and in the dialectical approach, the two are opposites. Well, in part, I think what Vivacki does and talks about, which is very interesting because it mirrors something else that I'm reading about at the moment, which is Schelling, is that this idea that actually the easiest way to describe it is Vivacki talks about the difference between the living in the having mode and living in the being mode, and the two are not necessarily compatible if we use inherited models of thinking. So the having mode is, I have thoughts, I have feelings, I have access to the world, I can calculate what is in front of me, I can sense this, and I can account for this and put it into a categorical schema of things. Whereas the being mode is something which is less easy to describe, because it only emerges through symbols. It only emerges through a kind of creative engagement, a poetic engagement with the world. And that what comes from our inner self and sense of ourselves is often dismissed, and it's kind of if you something like a Freudian model is about repression of these things, and it's about we live in a world which describes thinking as like a computer system. Well, that denies the more numinous and transcendent experience of engagement and thinking and experience and being. Now, I'm not a philosopher, and I certainly can't keep track of Kierkegaard and Heidegger and Schopenhauer and Schelling and Nietzsche, and John Vervaeke does this really good kind of way, detailed way of touring it. And there's a huge book list that's associated with these videos, which if I was 18 years ago, if I was 18 years old now, I would be, you know, kind of looking at and certainly considering. I don't agree with everything he says. I think he's a bit harsh on Jung, to be honest with you, although he does regard Jung as a kind of prophet of the meaning crisis, or the solution towards the meaning crisis. And he combines this notion of kind of Gnostic knowing as something which goes beyond and takes us beyond this Cartesian problem of knowing, that it is really just about facts and figures and calculated processes, rather than it being about something which comes from the intuition, comes from the place that we don't know, the collective conscious, the out, those things outside of describable human experience. So that's been, you know, that's been a major part of what I've been doing. When I get to the gym, you know, listen to a podcast for an hour and kind of see if I can keep up and engage with these discussions, and then, you know, try and relate that back in some way to what we do now. So anyway, the next song I've got up, lined up, here I am jumping back into DJ mode, is Paris / Only by Dur.
Le signal de la tour de contrôle s'allume et un avion disparaît dans le ciel sans lendemain. Les lueurs striant l'horizon noir de brume ressemblent à des fantômes de lumière dans le matin. il est annoncé.
So following on from John Vivacki and his lecture series Awakening from the Meaning Crisis, I have started to kind of follow an instinctual intuition, if you like, which is to start to find out more about romantic poetry and romantic philosophy, which is kind of something I've never studied before and not really aware of. And that period of the late 18th and early 19th century, before materialism and rationalism took hold and came to dominate a view of the world which is highly materialistic, highly functional, if you like, and that it was seen as, you know, there's that famous idea that, you know, from Marx, that the role of previously philosophers have only sought to understand the world. He argued that it was the job of philosophers to change the world, and, you know, flipping that back to where it should be, which is the job of philosophers to understand things. Change is going to happen anyway. But it's the notion of the kind of romantic notion of the poetic individual, the poetic creative aspect to ourselves, and the sense of a self. Where does the sense of ourself come from? We're not just a collection of artifacts, of processes, or organic parts. We're not a machine. We go beyond that. But if we focus too much on one side, and to some extent the history of kind of modern philosophy has been really to kind of downplay, and people are quite dismissive of romanticism and the role that, and maybe for good reason, and I don't know enough about this at this point to kind of be able to explain this or justify this, and it would probably be 10 years worth of study to get to the point where I do a reasonable job of it. But, you know, the notion that we intuit as a primary mode of engaging with the world is that which is within, we don't pay much attention to that. And if you look at our schooling system, it's all, you know, it's clear that, you know, contemplation and reflection and creative practice are being, in the British schooling system, are being squeezed out in favour of facts and processes, and in favour of skills. And they're all external things. They're very essential, but it's not the only part of the learning process. The learning process also has this: you have to tune into your intuition. You have to tune into something which goes beyond merely dealing with instructions. And in the closest we get to this now, I think Jung said this. He said, you know, most people aren't in touch anymore with this spiritual side, if you want to call it that, of ourselves. But the closest we get to it now, modern Western society, is through music. Because we've lost that participation mystique, we've lost a sense of what the numinous is, we've lost a sense of that merging and that emergent, you know, if you the rose that blooms, where does that come from? How does that know and how does that follow? Well, we can explain that through genetics and through evolution, but that sense of wonder that we are hoping to catch on to, and we don't prioritise that anymore, and we certainly don't prioritise it in a lot of our schooling system, which would be able to tell you very, you know, appropriately about the genetic mechanisms and the chemical mechanisms that drive plant growth and being growth. But it doesn't tell you anything about the experience of that. It doesn't tell you what that means, why that is meaningful. And this is what this is about. It's a kind of return to the meaningful, and how, if you like, we go beyond or accept that we are bounded in our time, but that we are constantly learning for the future. So there's this sense, and this is something that Schelling, I think I'm taking from what Schelling talks about, is the notion that it's this idea of a will to knowledge, that the will to knowledge, we try and establish balance and harmony, homeostasis, but life never allows us to maintain balance and harmony and homeostasis, because it's always pushing us into disequilibrium. That's just the nature of the energy that drives us. So how do we maintain that? Now, if knowledge and understanding and comprehension and consciousness is striving to push forward, always striving to push forward, like the rose that blooms, or the ivy that grows around a tree, which, you know, follows a pathway, which germinates, follows its genius, and we are. If we stop asking questions, if we stop thinking, if we stop allowing ourselves to seek new understanding and knowledge, what we do is we revert back to the last stage at which we had harmony, the last stage at which we had balance. But it's usually a false view of the past, because we're never totally sure what that was and how it functioned and how it worked. So what we're doing, and I think if there's a good argument to be made that we can see this process happening around us, is that the society, and Arnold Toynbee in his History of Civilization kind of talks about this, that a society that stops seeking knowledge and new understanding becomes, if you like, atrophied, and you become dependent on knowledge that was established in the past, but which is no longer relevant for today or would prepare you for the future. I think I might have explained that reasonably well. One would hope.
Become beloved.
Last week I managed to get out and meet up with Lucy Stevens, who's a visual and sound artist based in Leicester, and we met up at Leicester Museum and I recorded some work she was doing with the museum service for the project that she's running called Colour Coded Birds. So have a listen to this.
So my name's Lucy Stevens. I'm a local Leicester-based artist. I work with sound and visuals. So my main inspiration is birds. So I'm really looking forward to working with Leicester Museum's bird skin collection, but also birds on mounts and bird eggs, to pull them out of the basement storage and show them to the public, and then create some contemporary artwork in response to them. So the project's moved on quite a bit. I think when we spoke, we were in Aylston Meadows. I was with my dog Millie. It was quite cold, so it must have been the start of the year. But I think I still hadn't decided what artwork I was going to create, and already I've created quite a bit. So I've made 12 sculptures. So these are kind of A4 size sculptures. So A4 is like the size of printing paper. They'll be laid flat in two cabinets, and they will hold the museum's bird egg collection. So I've created the sculptures based on the colour of the bird, its conservation status, what type of predator attacks it. So it might be a sparrowhawk that eats a great tit or a blue tit. It might be a bullfinch trying to camouflage itself. So I've made 12 different sculptures already. So this has been made from zero formaldehyde MDF, so that it's safe to sit with the collections and have the actual bird eggs sat within the sculpture. So I'm quite excited to show these, because I've never, ever shown sculpture before. So it's a little bit nerve-wracking, but it's really exciting to be able to showcase something brand new. So what I'm hoping to get out of today is to really see what the bird skin collection looks like in the cases. I've got this idea that I'll have all the red birds together, all the yellow birds together, and all the blue birds together, but I don't actually know what it's going to look like, because I've only really seen the birds in their plastic bags. I have a list of them, but I don't really know what they'll look like together. In my mind, it'll be this, you know, big kind of vibrant mixture of reds and yellows and blues, but I'm testing it out purely because I'd like to know in advance, and because of interpretation. So the exhibitions team need me to make a decision on the order of the birds so that they can figure out what the interpretation will look like. And I'm also having some photographs taken today, which hopefully will be added into the display of the exhibition. And I'm selecting birds on mounts as well, and that's because I'm making some wooden totems in response to them. So there's quite a lot to do today. I don't know if we're going to have time to do it all, but we'll see. I can always come back. So we're at Leicester Museum and Art Gallery today, and we are looking at the bird skins in the cabinets, and we're just having photographs taken for the exhibition, which will be added to the graphics on the wall. So we've got all the drawers open, we're looking at birds on mounts, different bird skins, different colours, and just kind of staging some images. But later on we'll be looking at appropriate cases and how the birds will be laid out in the cases as well. Well, it's the smell kind of hits me. I don't know if Heather's used to the smell.
No, you never get used to the smell of the chemicals that are used to preserve them. But then there's the wonder when you see them all in little rows.
Yeah, it's a chance you'd never be able to, unless you were like taking part in bird ringing, you wouldn't be able to be this close to them, would you? And see the kind of details in the feather up close, and yeah, it's really fascinating. And the label just kind of adds that history to it, doesn't it? They're very, very delicate, very light. So, yeah, you have to be really careful getting them out of the bags, really.
So they're all kept in little bags, which help to protect them from insect infestations, which taxidermy collections are prone to getting. There are specific insects that will eat the feathers and the skin. So they're all in individual bags, in drawers, in locked cupboards to protect as much as possible.
And they're all in really great condition by the looks of it. So.
And the one that I'm holding is the golden oriole, and that is from 1869, this specimen.
And I've got the greater spotted woodpecker, and that's from 1983. It was found in Thurmaston Lane in Leicester.
Some of the collections come from specific people who had large collections that donated them to the museum. Some of the specimens, particularly later ones, will be individual specimens that perhaps someone found dead in their garden or their cat caught or was got run over by a car. And they come in and would have been mounted.
Yeah, that's normally the way. I'd say a lot of the collections I've seen, kind of local birds, are based in Leicester and Leicestershire. Yeah. And like you say, they normally collide with cars, windows, or get caught by cats. So it's, when people get upset about museum collections, you have to be clear that, you know, these haven't been shot out of the sky.
The much older historic ones, there was a different belief in, you know, collecting them.
Yeah,
and
course.
People would go out and want to collect one of each or 20 of each. But that was very much in the sort of 18th century, early 19th. It's certainly not how it's done now. Particularly with the specimens that are found in Leicester and Leicestershire for us, gives a clear idea of the types of activity that there is in this area over the last 100, 150 years. And across the country, all museums will have local collections like this, so it gives a much bigger picture. And we can look back on the records and see if specimens were much rarer or if they're much more common in the past, and it informs future for us to be able to see how many specimens there are around now.
And I think it's nice to be able to have, you know, a variation of the same bird in the drawer as well, because you've got, you know, probably, I don't know, 10, 12 great spotted woodpeckers in there, and you can see that they're all different sizes. They might have different, slightly different variations in patterns or colouring on their chest.
Male and female juveniles as well. So we've got skins, which are just specimens that have been mounted flat, stuffed to give them some body shape. But we've also got mounted specimens on twigs and branches that have been mounted to look realistic, in a realistic pose. To give people more of an idea when they visit the museum of how the specimen might look in the wild.
Yeah.
Can I just pop and get my little coloured stickers whilst
Prem's
still here?
Yeah.
Just a couple of minutes and then we can start.
So I've already selected which bird skins I'm going to use in the cabinets. So we're just having photos taken today. We're going to look at the cabinets that the birds will go in. We'll take them out of their bags and display them in the cabinets. Make a decision about that today. And then we can let Simon in design know, because obviously there needs to be some interpretation that goes with it. So we'll think we'll number the birds, and then we'll just have the name of the bird on a sign outside, because we don't want to crowd the cabinet, really. And then I've brought a sculpture with me today, and I'm going to test that in the cabinet, see what that looks like. And I'm going to select four birds on mounts as well, because I'm going to create four totems which relate to the bird. So they'll relate to the bird's colour, its conservation status, its habitat, its behaviour, that type of thing. So, yeah, I've really moved on since our first conversation. Lots has happened. So I'm looking at kind of colour coding. So I'm looking at red, yellow and blue, so kind of the main primary colours, and kind of making... I'm still looking at categorising the collection using colour, so that's still my main theme, and that's how the birds will be on display. And I've created some colour charts as well, which look at... really simple colour charts that look at the colour of the bird, and then the colour the traffic light colour of its conservation status. So if I'm looking at a bullfinch, I'll look at red, and then I'll look at its conservation status, which is amber, so I have those two colours together, and then another bird and another bird, and then I've combined that into one piece. So you'll see some quite bold kind of abstract pieces there, as long, you know, along with you know, the birds in the cabinets and some sculptures. And I'm really excited about showing the sculptures, because I've never shown sculpture before, so this will be a first for me, really. Yeah, it's really exciting. Right. Just
going to
see what this looks like in that other cabinet down there.
Okay, these, yep. These are... My name's Heather Southorn. I'm the collections manager for the museum service, and I am responsible for the care, storage and display of the collections within the service. I've been liaising with Lucy as part of her exhibition by helping her to choose specimens that fit into her remit. It's invaluable to us. It means that we can get out collections that we wouldn't ordinarily be able to get out because they don't fit into any of our current exhibition strand. It means that the public get to see a really interesting variety of collections that they might not realise that we have in store, and also have hopefully a bit of an understanding of why we collect and why we might have these collections. It will hopefully encourage questions for us about our collections, and we'll be able to inform and educate the public along the way.
Green woodpecker, because of its head.
Oh,
it's got a red head.
Museums across the country all have their own individual collections, and they will all have collections that are a lot of them will have taxidermy collections or furniture collections or social history collections, and the importance of that to the country and to the regions within that with your local museums is invaluable, because what we are doing is being able to keep for future generations ephemera and objects that people might not necessarily see as important to keep. Obviously, Picassos and, you know, artworks that go on display, it's very obvious why we keep those and display those, because they're lovely to look at, but some of the collections aren't quite so obvious. And the taxidermy, our entomological collections, which are the insects, and social history, which might not be so pretty, the importance of that in terms of historical what we used to collect, what we collect now, because we don't always collect the same things. The research that people can do on those collections, which inform how life was like in the past and how that links to future times, is also invaluable. The collections that we collect, which are local to Leicester and Leicestershire, are part of the history and heritage of this region. They belong to the people. We just hold them for them as an important storage and repository of the past moving into the future. Because I'm the collections manager and I have conservation and restoration background, not a curatorial background. So from my point of view, when I look at collections, it shows me the scope of what we've got, because I don't necessarily go into these cabinets all the time, because I don't need to, unless they're being used for an exhibition. So in terms of being able to see what we've got, I haven't been into every cabinet here. So every time I open a cabinet or a drawer, I'm seeing something new, even though I've been here 20 years. And for me, that's magical, because I have the privilege of being able to look into the back storage areas. But it's also in terms of a documentation exercise. What I see is this is a huge documentation. It's not a project, because it is documented, but it's a resource. And we have a lot of researchers who come and look at our collections and study it or take DNA samples from it. So our collection and the other collections around the country are used much more broadly. So even if they're not looked at by the public, they're still a really important resource to keep.
The best positioning is... we need to do it in advance, just because of interpretation panels and stuff like that. Yeah, just see what they look like. Nice to do it.
Sorry, I'm a noisy shoe. Be ruining you.
No, not at all.
Is there any
you're more worried about that you'd want to do first in case we run out of time or...
Let's go for red then, yeah. So...
So Robin, Bullfinch,
yeah.
Chaffinch.
Yeah.
Okay, what, so...
So we've got a Robin, which is just... It's that.
Is it? That's,
yeah, that's
the Robin.
Robin.
Okay. Bullfinch is 401. The next cabinet.
Yeah, that's the next one.
Yeah. Chaffinch is 402, that's this cabinet as well.
Okay.
We need to get them caught and the plastic folded within the card.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm pleased we've done that because that would be. Well, obviously we need it for interpretation, but...
So are they all going in these cases?
Yeah, I've got three of them.
This size case?
Yeah. Because the tabletop ones will be used for the sculptures that will hold the birds.
Oh, yes, the eggs, yeah.
Because there's 12 of those, I need more space.
I've sent in a request for the loan of the...
Oh, the Firecrest egg.
But I haven't heard that.
Fingers crossed. I did look for replicas, but I can't find anything. I've got a horrible feeling if I end up getting something.
Like that.
Yes, yeah, I'm fine. Yeah, yeah, fine. All right. Oh, yeah, yeah. So I'll email you and we can book in another session to do yellow and blue and
yeah.
I'll get Spencer in to just look at cases. But yeah, I think that's
good.
Getting
there.
Awesome.
Great.
Thank you. No, we've taken up more of your time than
that's
you.
That's okay.
Because you're so busy.
I am horrendously busy coming up. So I shall do my
So today we didn't have enough time. I think there was way too much to do and I overestimated probably how much time the team had. So I think it went well though. I think I thought that the birds in the cabinets would look more vibrant than they do. I still think they do look vibrant, but obviously looking at the birds you realise you don't have many red birds, because that's all we got around to doing today was the red birds. So you know you'll have birds that have red heads, like the green woodpecker and the goldfinch. Obviously, you've got the robin with its red breast, and you've got the bullfinch. But when birds die, obviously their colours fade a little bit. So it's not this kind of bright, kind of vibrant collection of colours that I thought it would be. It's probably a bit muted, a bit more quiet. But I think the specimens do look really great together and I'm really pleased with how we've laid them out. And yeah, the birds on mounts I think look really great and I'm really excited to see how they'll pair with the totems that I create. But yeah, we'll need to come back and see what the yellow and the blue birds look like and also select mounts for sculptures and mounts for the birds on mounts as well. Felt really good. I mean, obviously, I've handled them before and I've photographed them. Well, Bill Neusinger photographed them for me, so we've gone through them before, and it's always quite a kind of quick, rushed process. But it's nice to be able to, yeah, kind of remind myself of why I'm doing it, really, is to be able to showcase these birds to other people. You know, I've handled them a few times now, but it still feels really special to be able to do that, to be able to get up really close to them and just to kind of see that detail and just realise how delicate they are. Yeah, and I think this whole show is just about kind of elevating them really to the public and creating contemporary artwork to celebrate them. Yeah, they're really, really beautiful specimens and I hope other people can see that and appreciate that and want to learn more about them.
Thank you.
that was West Bank by Malcolm Parson, followed by Falling In by Mark Slater. Send me a message if you want to take part in a conversation and discussion. It's Twitter and Instagram at Rob W Media. The website is robwattonmedia.net. If you want to help out to support and fund and to, you know, just say thanks, not thanks, that's the wrong word, to just give a little bit of encouragement to carry this kind of conversation and discussion on, there's a Patreon page, so you can find the link on the website. And thanks as well to Sound Art Radio and Leicester Community Radio for allowing me the opportunity to just kind of open up without really any strong idea of what I'm going to say and how I'm going to say it. And I think that's kind of really, you know, very, very opposite way of doing radio. And I'm trying to find how to be more confident about this. I certainly don't want, you know, this idea of doing that was and this is not my idea of radio. But we'll have a go. All right. Speak to you soon. You've been listening to Distraction Therapy with me, Rob Watson. Find out more at robwatsonmedia.net or follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Rob W Media.